Hello and welcome to Adapt Happy, the podcast from the good folk at Adapt Radar. I'm John Jordan, and joining me is our DeFi expert Ilya, and we're gonna do some roundup of 2020. How does that sound, Ilya? Sound good?
Hello, everyone. Yeah, it sounds good. Let's do it.
Okay, so 2020. What happened, Ilya? what
did happen? Oh, so many things, right? But you know, DeFi was kind of the big catalyst, the big driver of everything, and everything revolved around DeFi.
Let me just stop you there, because it's interesting. I was looking at some data for a conference I was doing, and literally, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. DeFi is the big story, but nothing really starts until kind of June, really, on the DeFi side. That would be my view. Would that be your view? It seemed like the first few months at the time we thought lots of stuff was happening. But you look back at the graphs now of kind of activity and stuff, and basically nothing was happening or very little. Is that a fair assessment?
So I would say that when it feels like on the surface nothing is happening, that's when the most things are happening underneath. And then you kind of see the product of that coming out in the summer. So there's two kind of big events that I kind of want to point out in the beginning of the year that I think maybe get overlooked a little bit, right? So there is kind of the yield farming and governance tokens, which we'll talk about a little bit later, right? That is, you're right, that comes out in the summer with like Compound, right? That big kind of event. But it really starts, like yield farming really starts with synthetics. And I think that happens kind of more towards over the winter, right? Like they started it early. It proved to be a kind of successful thing for their ecosystem as a token model. And I think that other people picked up on that, right? So I think that, you know, despite Compound kind of looking as a kind of the starter of that, it actually started with synthetics. And the other big event that I think we can't overlook was MakerDAO. Right? Like when they near collapsed, I think in March, right? Like that was a big thing for the ecosystem for two reasons. One, it kind of pointed to a number of issues that will be popping up later on. And it also kind of signaled the kind of community orientation within blockchain, right? Like this was a big stress test. And despite things looking really like, you know, bad for a little while, the community rallied around the project. And I think that this is kind of became a recurring theme throughout the year. Things would kind of, people would try things would break, and then the community would rally and kind of pick up the pieces and move forward. So I think that, you know, the whole thing with MakerDAO and kind of that foreshadowed a lot of things with kind of collateral moving forward and kind of that expansion.
Mm. That's a good point. I mean, I think this is kind of the typical thing that commentators say, isn't it? They kind of reframe the question. I mean, for me, the kind of the DeFi as a proper thing actually kind of started in December 2019 when MakerDAO did its multi-collateralization. So previously you had to take ETH and then you got DAI out of it, but then they for the first time started to allow other tokens to go in there. And there was quite a kind of an uptick of interest there, because I guess people had tokens that they didn't know what to do with, like BAT tokens and stuff. But there wasn't like that was just a very singular thing. That was like MakerDAO did that. It's a good point on the synthetic one. I mean, so synthetics has been around for a while, but they started to allow people to kind of, as you say, yield farm their SNX token by kind of staking into liquidity pools. As you say, it didn't kind of massively take off, but synthetic was quite a kind of interesting project, because it started to kind of link up to other projects. I can't remember exactly when it was, but when synthetic and Chainlink is something that's kind of mentioned quite a lot, isn't it? That seemed to be one of the kind of the first yield farming things.
And then it spread, right? So you started to see kind of, you know, the balancers, the Uniswaps of the world kind of join in into kind of, you know, after Compound, right? What was really exciting for a while during the summer is that a lot of these projects linked up to help in kind of joint liquidity mining activities, right? So like, I think at one point on Balancer, you could get like, I think it was synthetic tokens and Balancer tokens and Curve tokens, right? Like they would all like, there would be like joint pools where like, if you were mining one thing, you would get a whole host of tokens because they crossed over with other liquidity mining programs. And so I think that was kind of, again, it was part of it was important because of attracting liquidity, but part of it kind of signaled the composability factor in the industry and how different ecosystems, and, you know, tried to c- collaborate and actually kind of, you know, combine their efforts to kind of better, you know, both themselves and the ecosystem as a whole.
Mm. And I guess kind of composability just means different kind of products, different dApps can interact with each other. Often the kind of the money Lego kind of term, I guess, is still kind of appropriate, at least in terms of visualization. And I guess to some degree, this was we saw some downsides of this. So we saw when things like flash loans came in from Aave, I guess kind of at the start of 2020, or at least in the first half of the year, then people started using flash loans where you could gain a lot of token value and pay very little for it, and that started to kind of change the exploits that could be done because you had access now to millions of dollars of tokens. And I guess we, you know, throughout the year, I mean, you've written a lot about it, is even now we still see a lot of these kind of exploits, whether you count them as kind of aggressive hacks or just you know, people using code in ways that the creators are kind of didn't foresee. But that's the downside. But I think we've not seen any catastrophic kind of exploits like that, which is kind of what you're, I guess, in the space always worried about, that you'll build up a big tower, your big Lego tower of money will have been built up, and then something at the bottom suddenly, you know, collapses and then the whole thing comes tumbling down. We've not seen that yet, and I guess we've had a year of kind of fairly robust people checking, obviously on the kind of white hat side, and people trying to exploit on the dark hat side.
The recent Compound event was a little bit scary, because I think that you know, as you mentioned, it's kind of like a tower where you have at the bottom kind of the foundational projects. I would say MakerDAO, Compound, Aave, maybe Synthetix, Uniswap, ones where, you know, that are used to kind of, and then on top of them, you see all kinds of kind of algorithms, other projects utilizing kind of several combinations. And so the recent situation where Compound had a massive liquidation because of kind of the signal that came from Coinbase Pro, or rather the Oracle from Coinbase, that was a little bit scary, right? Because not so much that, you know, the losses were catastrophic, but just the idea that one of the foundational Legos could suffer from something like this, because that, as you said, could kind of tip over the dominoes. But again, kind of we're seeing time and time again that, you know, the projects in the community kind of reacts pretty quickly and kind of looks for solutions and, you know, for the most part, finds these solutions. And so kind of the losses have been limited, and kind of the industry looks like it's trying to take steps forward. So that's very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, probably on the downside kind of trends of the year, I mean, oracles have pretty much been the main kind of problem. And I guess even going back to kind of whenever it was, the 12th, 13th of March, when basically we had a global sell-off of all assets, so stocks, gold, everything, crypto, all got sold off in kind of a massive wave of panic when people started realizing what COVID was going to do to the world economy. And that was interesting because that's, you know, the people were selling, so for, you know, suddenly people couldn't sell because you couldn't get transactions through the blockchain, so people couldn't sell as fast as they needed to, so that kind of acted as a circuit breaker. But it's kind of interesting that it seemed like on certain even centralized exchanges that their oracles failed and that saved Bitcoin from going to, I mean, seen things on some exchanges could have gone to zero or something, and clearly on MakerDAO again a similar thing happened, that the oracle couldn't update fast enough and if it had done, it would have liquidated pretty much everything. So I guess it's kind of interesting. It's kind of like the bomber taking off with a nuclear bomb on board and crashing and through some kind of luck of the system, not designed, the nuclear bomb doesn't go off. So I guess we have to keep that in mind, and I guess that's underpins everything we say, where this stuff is super risky and lots of very clever people building it, but there are these unforeseen circumstances, and that was pretty, yeah, that was lucky for the system. If that, you know, I think kind of obviously crypto would still be around if everything had worked as it should have worked, but I think we wouldn't have had the same year as we have had.
That's, you know, kind of, you know, playing off of that, you know, the industry this year has seen a lot of, you know, let's build, see, break, and try to fix it, right? Like, the standards for quality have really calmed down for a lot of these projects. We've seen kind of a wave, especially like if you look back to kind of the food meme wave for projects, no audits, right? And they're pretty, you know, a lot of these projects were pretty open about it, you know, no audits. And so you expectedly saw a lot of things break. You know, part of it, you know, was intended, right? Break, fix, iterate, right? It was a very kind of an agile development environment, which, you know, has its benefits. On the other side of it, you know, there's a few people that kind of understood the risks and try to profit off of, you know, off of those risks. But then you kind of see that, especially kind of with the, you know, media picking up the headlines, you know, TVL skyrocketing here and there, that you see more people who don't really understand the underlying risks, don't understand kind of what the protocols are doing, kind of trying to jump in into this kind of environment. And this is where you risk, you know, retail taking, you know, heavy losses that they're not expecting, right? It's one thing when the kind of participants understand what kind of losses that they can take. And, you know, it's a, you know, it's an understood risk. The other thing is when people are kind of just running in because they think there's free money falling from the sky and things turning, you know, badly for them, right? Because we've seen, you know, I think over the fall, there's been periods where like every other day it felt like a protocol was exploited, for example, right? So, you know, there's been two sides to this coin, right? From one side, the industry has been able to kind of iterate really quickly. And it's been really exciting to see kind of the new developments that have been happening. On the other side, kind of standards of quality, they will need to improve significantly for this to be kind of, you know, plausible, usable by retail audience.
I mean, it's kind of funny. I guess as should have been expected, we're kind of rehashing a lot of the discussions we previously had this year. And we did one podcast about risk. And I find risk fascinating because I just know in general people have. Unless you're really, most people have no idea about kind of risk, and some people have a over the top view of risk because they're just very because they know a lot about risk and they see risk everywhere. But I think it's kind of, in some ways my disagreement with you is I don't think many retail customers are involved because crypto is still so difficult that I think when things go wrong, it's even if people who didn't understand the risks, they should have understood the risks. And the risks of crypto are anything you put into crypto could go to zero. I mean, even probably I would say Bitcoin probably is the one that couldn't. But pretty much anything, certainly any token on Ethereum literally could go to zero. But it's very hard to kind of get people to actually think about that. And I guess I'm a bit more worried that I think I can't remember which organization it was. I think it's DeFi Pulse that actually had some sort of started to do some sort of risk. They started to have a risk score out of 100 or out of 10 or something, and it was just like no, because you know, I was just that kind of worried me because some of them had a risk of like 10 or something or 9 or something, and some had a risk of 2, and I was like, no, all of these have a risk of like 100 out of 100 or maybe 99 or maybe 198 or something, but the risk is not, you know, is this one's good because the code's been audited. It's like it's on a blockchain. the whole thing is it's, you know. And I think that's what worries me. And I guess for what we have seen, which is a good point you made, is for retail customers to get in, which is by which we mean people who aren't kind of crypto enthusiasts, then there will have to be, I think, some sort of centralized system or some sort of inbuilt system of insurance that will have to be in there. Because this isn't the risk of, you know, you buying Tesla stock and Tesla sort of going bust or something, you know, because we know there's laws around that and how you sell security and crypto doesn't have any of that stuff. So the risk clearly must be bigger. And so for it to even be licensed in any way for the retail investors, then whoever's offering the crypto thing must have kind of insurance built into that to some degree, I think.
Well, so I think that, you know, you kind of hit on a few important trends that kind of came out this year. One is that, you know, insurance does start to pop up, right? Like we do see, you know, Nexus Mutual kind of, you know, appearing more, at least in the conversations, right? You see,
it's quite clunky though, isn't it? I mean, I don't know how to use Nexus Mutual. It's just,
but you see things like Y-Insure then come out, right? Leveraging it, right, into their own products, and you know, you start to see kind of Y-covers, like, well, the NFT tokens coming up on OpenSea, and so yes, it's very early, very foundational. But it's very important that this is now, people are actually thinking about it now, right? Like that there is this risk and we need to cover it in order to kind of move forward. So I think that that's something that we'll look back at 2024 as something that was important, right? People started looking at insurance in a decentralized manner as something necessary for a lot of different components. The other thing is kind of the retail gateways, right? So if we do see kind of the PayPals of the world, the Facebooks of the world, trying to kind of get in on the retail game. Now, from that side of it, I think that the impact might actually be a lot more limited than some people think, because I think that, you know, with PayPal, I think the model right now is very similar to what you'll see with like Robinhood, where you can buy and sell, but you can't actually withdraw things to your wallet. So you can't really, like, you can buy Ethereum, right? But you can't really interact with the DeFi stack from PayPal. So to that end, kind of the impact that those gateways will have on the actual decentralized ecosystem might be very limited. It might create additional demand for Ethereum, for Bitcoin, for some of the layer one protocols. But the actual usage impact may be limited. On the other hand, things like Dharma, for example, right? The retail-facing higher-level applications that simplify, they abstract away the interaction with the lower-level protocols like Compound. Now that could, you know, we could see a lot more of, right? We start to see wallets start to kind of integrate kind of exchange swap functions into their interfaces. So I think that there is kind of a look from within the industry at making basic operations simpler for retail users. And the more kind of the Legos are integrated from kind of a retail perspective, probably not so much integrated as abstracted away, the more you will see retail users get excited and trying things, right? Because, you know, fixed income product could have its own kind of alternative in crypto. But that's where the kind of the risk component comes about, right? Because the more you abstract those things away, the more the retail user feels comfortable, but it's kind of a false sense of comfort, right? Because they just don't know what's underneath.
I was going to say, but I think, I mean, that's where it has to go. So, I mean, I've not used Dharma, but I've used Argent. And Argent, some of the approaches Argent have done, which is like a mobile-based kind of DeFi wallet, are really good. But in some ways, they make it more complicated than it is to use actual dApps. But I mean, that's because I'm in the space, I suppose. And it's this very, very difficult thing, I think, between making things simple and you know, dealing with the blockchain side of things. And I think that's an interesting line. But the wider point I was kind of moving on to was I think when people like Charles Schwab kind of do this sort of stuff, or you know, what these kind of like these big, you know, kind of financial institutions that people are using already, you know, that I think is the way it has to go. And all that stuff will be abstracted. And at the moment, people buy financial instruments that they have no idea what's underpinning them all. And I guess we kind of saw that with the credit crunch. You know, people were retail people were buying things that gave them a certain level of kind of interest, and they had no idea it was all in US mortgages that were toxic. So I don't think, from that point of view, I don't think that's necessarily a problem, because the trust is in that Charles Schwab will kind of deal with it. So I think that's kind of good. And you do have to abstract it away. And the risk there, I think, is kind of mitigated by the fact you've got these big institutions who are regulated. So obviously there'll be the stuff they'll be onboarding will not be Yam or Sushi Swap. You know, it'll probably take them a few years to get Compound, sort of thing. But and I guess on the other side, you'll have stuff like Coinbase pushing from the other way. So I guess what's interesting will be when someone comes in and buys Coinbase, something like that.
Well, the question then becomes, right, is like, where are you on the spectrum of kind of decentralization maximalists, right? Because, you know, you mentioned, for example, SushiSwap, right? And I think that one thing that we should talk about here is kind of decentralized ecosystems forming, right? So on one hand, right, you have the old institutions trying, especially the banking institutions, actually now trying to make an effort and try do things with blockchain, right? You see JP Morgan and the I think and their coin coming out. You see PayPal, you see Coinbase as kind of a more kind of from the blockchain community, but a very centralized institution. Binance, you see all these players kind of try to kind of stake out their place in the ecosystem. And those would be players that you'd say, you know, they would abstract and kind of take on the responsibility for a lot of these things. But within the industry, you also see kind of an ecosystem forming. I think one of the kind of chief ones right now is around kind of YEARN, where I think we've seen over the past month at least 5 mergers, right, with YEARN. And this is kind of the first time really where we see the concept of mergers appear for decentralized projects. I think some of these projects have anonymous founders, and they're still, they're able to work together. They're able to kind of mitigate the issues of some of these, right? So Pickle merged after they got exploited, and they actually set up a system to try to kind of, reconcile those losses, within the merger, right? So you see these, communities kind of try to kind of work through their issues in a decentralized manner. And I think that they will try to kind of propose an alternative to kind of the centralized paradigm, right? So depending on where you are within that spectrum, you see the development very differently, right? Because JP Morgan's coming in and kind of absorbing and abstracting away, Compound. Goes against a lot of what people who are building these applications believe in, right? So it really, it will be an interesting development to see in 2021.
But I think, those are definitely the two extremes of the spectrum, YEARN is probably the most interesting kind of a product of the year, in the sense that it's one guy who does it, Andre Cronje, kind of superstar sort of guy, and he comes up with this concept that basically you have a kind of a product that maximizes any yield that's available anywhere in the blockchain ecosystem, and you just buy that and you don't worry about, it's like an automatic, the best automatic money maker you can find. I mean, maybe some people argue you can do a better one or something, but obviously he's up there as a coder, so he's going to do something that's pretty well optimized. And then so many people got so rich off the back of it, so many developers got so rich off the back of that. At one point it was $40,000 token, I think it's about 26 now or something. It's still like a lot of money was made there. Only 30,000 tokens ever minted. That's right at the end of the spectrum. I mean you're never going to beat that in terms of the kind of inside knowledge and the ability to jump on new things. And as you say, it's very interesting. They're doing this sort of roll up of some projects like Pickle and SushiSwap that kind of didn't really work out in some ways and have a bad reputation. But obviously, they've seen something there as the community and rolled that up. But that's, you wouldn't want a retail investor to touch that. You wouldn't even really want many people in the blockchain space to touch that, because that's really quite extreme. What they're doing there, but for most people, it's just, we're interested, I guess, in blockchain because we're geeky little guys who are interested in computers and stuff. But most people just like, if I can, I just want to get some interest. If I can get 5%, brilliant. If I can get 10%, that's amazing. And if I can get that through Charles Schwab, then they just, in that sense, kind of blockchain just becomes part of the international, the global financial system. And people care about what they get out of it, but they don't care. It's like a sausage, isn't it? No one cares how you make the sausage, as long as the sausage tastes nice. I mean, that's how it's going to go. Maybe not next year, but 5-10 years.
I agree and I disagree, in the sense that, I do think that people don't necessarily, the retail user doesn't care what kind of powers the utility, right? They just need it to work, right? On the other hand, I do see kind of YEARN being more retail oriented than a lot of people would think. Because if you think about what happened, kind of one of the other big themes of 2020 was enormous gas fees on Ethereum. And what that caused was, for the retail user, right, it basically meant, participating in a lot of these, you know, yield farming activities and a lot of kind of even saving, it didn't make any sense because the amount of money you were making would be negated by the fees you'd be paying, depositing or withdrawing. What things like Wyvern did was optimize try to optimize the yield. And because you were kind of participating as part of a pool, kind of the effect of the fees was mitigated, right? So it was actually better in a lot of ways for the little guy, right, to participate as part of Wyvern than to participate on their own, right? And because they got squeezed out by the whales on kind of the direct interactions, right, the little guy, like Wyvern, was the alternative for him.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Okay, we've chopped up that for a bit. I guess let's take a bit of time, kind of predicting the future. I always like predicting the future, not because I think I'm right, because I know I'm not, and no one's right. That's kind of the point. But to try and kind of shape, you know, we've seen the trends of 2020 that we've tried to discuss. And then it's a case of I guess trying to put kind of some framework around how 2021 could go. Obviously it could go lots of different ways. How do you see it? Do you think we'll look back at 2020 as just being a weird year? There's this big DeFi kind of bubble explosion, whatever, and 2021 is it a bit more of a kind of normal year, some other kind of categories come back in, or do you see it being very much the whole dApp blockchain product space being led by DeFi again?
I think that DeFi will continue to be kind of a very important component, but as DeFi grows, and I think we started seeing that this year, the other sectors start to kind of pop up, right? Because what's important in the blockchain industry, the blockchain ecosystem, is the ability to monetize assets and all kinds of different assets, right? It can be, you know, as go as far as monetizing your time if you're talking about, you know, playing different games. Now, DeFi allows different sectors, different components, different projects to monetize their elements because it provides exchanges, kind of different platforms, the ability to kind of interact with the financial system within the industry. So as that financial system becomes more stable, gets stronger, the other components will be able to leverage it more and grow off of that, right? So I would expect, you know, gaming and art and so forth to kind of grow further and integrate. The other thing that will be very important, I think, in 2021 is that we'll see more of the kind of Ethereum alternatives. Basically, it's going to be a make it or break it for them, I think, in a lot of ways. Because 2020, in a lot of ways, was a product of 2018, 2019 building. Right. And Ethereum had a head start, but now we see kind of the alternatives, the big ones like Polkadot, Near, Cosmos, that, you know, they're starting to see dApps appear on them. And yes, Ethereum had a head start, but a lot of these guys, you know, will offer kind of EVM compatible solutions. And instead of having to build from scratch, they see a blueprint from Ethereum. And we already see that a lot of kind of ecosystems try to follow the DeFi blueprint, right? Build your own Uniswap, build your own Compound, build your own Maker, right? They don't have to go through all of the mistakes that the Ethereum ecosystem did. They can just look at what worked and what didn't, and they can start to port over things. Right now, all of the capital is flowing towards Ethereum, right? You see Wrapped Bitcoin, Wrapped Dash, Zcash, Filecoin, Ethereum Classic, like it's all porting over and trying to kind of integrate. Waves Neutrino had a big thing with, you know, when they integrated with Ethereum. But as the other ecosystems mature, I believe we will see those bridges start to work both ways. Because as exciting as Ethereum 2.0's launch was, we need to understand that's not going to do anything for dApps for at least the next year, right? Like this is great. This is exciting. This is a huge technological step forward. But, you know, if you're developing a dApp and you're running into a wall because the scalability and the gas fees are really hurting you, Ethereum 2.0 is not going to do anything for you for the foreseeable future. So, you know, people will start looking at, you know, the other alternatives. And if they are mature, this could really change and broaden the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've been looking a lot actually for the last last kind of 3 or 4 months at these kind of what we used to call Ethereum killers. Now we call kind of Ethereum kind of compatible kind of blockchains, I suppose. I don't think anyone thinks Ethereum's going to get killed anytime soon, particularly after the year now. And I think what's interesting is, as you pointed out, everyone wants to have bridges to Ethereum because Ethereum, whereas all the value is now, so like, you know, wherever it is, like $12 billion of value locked into these DeFi dApps. So everyone knows that the value's there. I think what's interesting at the moment is, as soon as you have a bridge, you basically have the value flowing into Ethereum because that's where, you know, you see that with Bitcoin now, you know, kind of fascinating sort of scenario. And I think that's kind of the problem of having bridges is you know, be careful where the flow is going to be. I think from what I've seen and what I've heard of some of these developers talking about how they're using these new blockchains is they're using them very much as an experimentation kind of approach. So they'll still have their main product will be on Ethereum. That's where the value is locked. That's where all the kind of big activities happening. But if you have a much faster blockchain, so I guess, and there's been quite a lot of talk about Solana is one that's been picking up quite a bit of interest. You mentioned Near, which has also done some. I'm trying to think of other ones. I think Polkadot and Cosmos are probably a bit of a way off yet, but some of these faster blockchains, you can just do different sorts of projects, different sorts of product, but have a different user experience because they're, you know, going to be very fast kind of interactions. So I think that will those kind of new blockchains will allow a lot of experimentation. And I guess if something takes off, that's when you'll see the bridge start to be quite valuable because value will flow from Ethereum into something that is seen as a success. But I guess the other thing you point out, you know, Ethereum's been running since whatever it is, like 2015, as a base layer, and you need that time to kind of prove out that there's not any horrible bugs in it, and it just, you know, it just kind of works. And I guess any new blockchain, people aren't going to be sticking billions of dollars into that straight off because, you know, it's only, you know, these things have only really mainnet gone live, you know, a few months ago, and things like Cardano, which is, I guess, a lot of interest in, still doesn't have smart contracts running, you know. So they've got a lot of building just in terms of their layer one infrastructure, really, before you can expect anything to happen. And I think, you know, that's good for experimentation. I don't really see a lot of change from that point of view in 2021, really. I think we'll start to get an idea of who the rivals are. Lots of people say there's going to be, you know, a handful of smart contract blockchains. I think we'll see who they are, but I don't think anything's going to surpass the value of Ethereum.
I would be very careful saying that because I think in the traditional ecosystem, we have seen that the incumbents kind of lose their market share extremely quickly, right? If you remember, you know, there was a point where smartphones were all about Research in Motion and BlackBerry, right? And then, you know, it seemed like overnight it was all about, you know, iPhones and Androids. You know, what's important here is where organic development is happening, right? So Ethereum, you know, became so popular and was able to maintain its popularity in the face of kind of all of these, as you call them, Ethereum killers, because that's where organic development was. This is where developers were playing around, they were building documentation, they were creating this kind of network effects. And I think that we're starting to see that with a few other ecosystems, and we might not see the dApps come up on them for, you know, for a few months or, you know, maybe a little bit longer than that, but kind of, you can see kind of the signs are there because organic growth is happening there, right? This is where things are happening. And then as far as capital, I think that the industry has proven to be, very, risk happy. So I don't know if the fact that, you know, these ecosystems have been running on mainnet for not very long will stop anybody from pouring billions. You know, we've seen with things like SushiSwap that billions pour in extremely quickly.
But the thing with SushiSwap was it had composability. So everything was on Ethereum because that was the only game in town. But as soon as there was some success on Ethereum, then everyone obviously goes to Ethereum. I think 2021 will be slower. Will be at the moment. There's like a dozen different blockchains out there that could be important. But you need basically developers are on all of these because they can all get, you know, you can get paid to kind of build things on there. They're all experimenting away. They need to decide which are going to be the one or two or three that they're actually going to all pile into and then build composability on that, because that the Ethereum basically, you know, is the flywheel effect, wasn't the network effect. That was why the DeFi thing got so crazy so quickly, was everyone piled in and it was the only game in town to begin with, but everyone knew what to do, and then you had this big thing being built. I think at the moment we're seeing, as far as I see it, we see individual developers choosing a blockchain for whatever reason and building on that. But we don't see 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 different dApps going on to those things that are going to build together. And I think that's what I would be looking for. And I think that 2021 will be the year in which we'll work out whether you know, say Binance Smart Chain seems to work fine, has Binance behind it. Nothing's really happened there. I mean, basically you have a lot of copies of stuff that's on Ethereum. So you know, I kind of think we have to take at least 6 months to see which of the, you know, developers to understand which are the ones they're going to choose. And then maybe to the second half of the year, we'll start to see people then, because it's very quick to deploy these things, as you point out. You have EVM compatibility, which basically means anything that runs on Ethereum can run on any of these other blockchains. So I think then you start to see the kind of the next, potentially the next kind of bubble.
So I really, you know, I kind of agree with the timeframes. I don't know if I would call it a bubble, but one thing to keep in mind is I don't think it will be an either or type of thing where the developers will choose one blockchain. So as an example, right, I think, you know, if you're developing on Polkadot or Near, those are, you know, both Rust protocols, right? So, you know, you kind of have your, you know, way going in between, right? If you're building on Ethereum, it's really easy for you to go to Binance Smart Chain. There is kind of, there'll be, I see more dApps launching in multiple chains. The question is how far will the blockchains be able to go to be able to support, you know, multiple environments for these dApps, right? So, you know, will it be easier? Will we see protocols that kind of make it easier for developers to support these multiple environments, to sync these multiple environments? Because we already see games doing it, right? We see games launching, let's say, on Ethereum and Tron.
Really not much. I mean, I think there was a point a year and a half ago where that was a big thing. And the reason I disagree with you on this point is as soon as you can do one thing well by focusing on it. As soon as you do two things, then you're doing them kind of probably half as well, or maybe you're good and do them, you know, slightly better. But as soon as you're launching things on three, then you've got all the technical support stuff, which is, you know, not necessarily the easiest thing. And also with the DeFi dApp, you're splitting your liquidity. So, you know, if I'm a user and suddenly you're on Polkadot and Near, well, which one do I choose? You know, I think the experimentation will be less, and I think will be slower. I think once people have decided, that's what people want to see what's going to be the leader, and then they'll all pile in.
So I agree with that as a 2020 vision, but here's the thing, right? I would say that this is more like an iOS Android type of thing, right? Like when you're playing a game, right, you want to be able to access it from iOS or Android, and there shouldn't be separate ecosystems, right? For now it is, because, you know, interoperability was a big thing, you know, everybody talked about, but it's been very limited in its implementation. But once that gets further, right, those do not need to be separate ecosystems, right? We don't see it as surprising for, you know, a mobile game to be supporting iOS and Android, right? So I don't see that as something, you know, out of this world for them to be able to support, you know, let's say, I don't know, Tron and Ethereum, or, you know, Ethereum and Near and Polkadot, if those blockchains at layer one, right, make it more kind of plausible, more comfortable for, and I actually see, you know, maybe services pop up that actually, you know, make those steps easier. But you do expect that, you know, as you said, retail users don't care what's running underneath, right? But they just want the simplest, easiest, cheapest thing. So it's possible that, you know, certain functions for games, for example, would be executed on one blockchain, while, let's say, store of value happens on another blockchain, right? We haven't even gotten, you know, to the question of actual storage, which becomes really important for things like NFTs. I don't know that necessarily, you know, developers will be cornered into choosing one blockchain. I think that, you know, this will depend a lot on those blockchain ecosystems, how far they're willing to go to make life easier for developers.
Good. Well, I think it's always good to agree to disagree. Yeah. I don't like those podcasts where everyone goes, oh, great point. Yeah, I agree. Generally, I think we agree, but I think it's kind of good that for 2021, which no one knows, so we can't say one of us is right, more right than the other one, at least for a year. Excellent. Thank you very much for your time, Ilya. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to the podcast, Dap Happy, the podcast all about dApps. We hope you enjoy it. Please do subscribe. Come back next time to hear what we are talking about.